Ashraf Patel is going to help us make sense of this, because now the spotlight once again on South Africa. Ashraf, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Hope all is well.
All good. How are you?
No complaints. All good.
This trade spotlight once again on South Africa. Ashraf, where do we start here?
Well, very interesting. You know, when Bafana had some visa delays, I kind of had a sense that something was in the pipeline, as always with the Trump administration.
You believe that could be linked, Ashraf?
Well, everything is linked these days, especially with trade and politics. It's all one kind of ecosystem.
Yeah, so it's not just Safa dropping the ball here. There could be something bigger at play also.
Well, I think Trump likes to give hints first before he goes with a big bang approach. But look, this is not surprising for kind of the IR scholars for several reasons. One is, if we were to remember his very first gambit when he became president last year for the second term, was the massive tariffs against most nations, from the EU to China to India to most of sub-Saharan Africa to Brazil, etc. And I think the administration has kind of assessed that after a year, and they kind of realize that there are differential powers. So with China, you know, Trump had to have a completely different strategy and have a much more balanced approach, noting that China has critical minerals that the U.S. needs. U.S. has the market that China needs. So they found some kind of symbiosis. But the challenge for EU is different in different sectors, especially big tech and agriculture. Unfortunately for Global South, particularly South Africa, Brazil, and India, we are in the middle of a lot of the Trump tariffs on industrial goods and some of the services. So I think that's where they see the weaker countries. I think they named 60 countries in the latest tariffs. But this time is interesting, and I think we'll go through the questions. But this time, it's kind of linked quite ironically to labor, or forced labor, as they call it, is a instrument of, you know, IR, but also the way they see it, forced labor goes against their laws, et cetera, et cetera.
It's pretty rich, Ashraf, if I'm thinking about it now. In fact, someone on the WhatsApp line, Nat, saying US policies are everything that we are against here in South Africa. But just think that, I think that WhatsApp, just quickly aside, for me, it's pretty rich. US tariff proposal citing concerns around alleged slave labor practices in South Africa. Ashraf, let's just back it up here quickly. What about Latin America and the United States actually abusing Latin American labor outside of the country, even inside the US, Afro-Americans, and lest we forget, what about the native Red Indians? The genocide that was committed, but they also abused the native Red Indians from a labor perspective. So I think this is very rich, coming from the United States, claiming slave labor practices in South Africa. Then we can even go to the Far East, how they've expanded their labor footprint there and outsourced everything to Vietnam, Cambodia, and back then to China. Very rich coming from the US, though.
Absolutely, absolutely. Look, this is part of what is called globalization and its discontent. So you are 100% right. In the 80s and 90s, U.S. multinationals really made super profits off the backs of very low labor in authoritarian regimes across Asia and Latin America and Africa. So they made their wealth over decades on that model. Yes, you're right. It's also ironic that in the U.S., especially in the southern states, most of the Mexican and Latin American labor are on farms, agricultural farms, where they earn below the wage line. So technically, one can classify that as forced labor. But I think their strategy or legal tactic is written in the American law. The definitions are slightly different from that of, let's say, the ILO. Now, that's interesting because their legal system has a different kind of interpretation of what is forced labor. It's framed in their version of human rights. So I think they're also getting at China in some way, because there is this narrative that a lot of the Chinese state-owned enterprises and large-scale corporations and agri-corporations in China does use, let's call it, prison labor. And those still need to be tested, but there are lobbies in the US that's saying, look, let's go for this forced labor thing, because if we say that in our law, prison and forced labor is illegal, then they're using the Section 301 to then extend it into trade deals. So it's a very wily kind of tactic, trade strategy tactic that they're applying here. It's a very specific, and I think they have very specific outcomes that they have in mind.
Could part of, if we're talking outcomes, Ashraf, why did the United States announce its withdrawal from the International Labor Organization? Is it about credibility, or perhaps is it to be in line with the consistency, I put that in air quotes, demonstrated in respect of Washington's labor-related criticisms of South Africa in this context? Why did they leave the ILO? For what?
The ILO has been in the sights of the Trump administration from the first term. Remember, the ILO and UNESCO and the UN Climate Change or Environment Program are really the very fundamentals of international cooperation in the world today. And as a nationalist, for Trump, he feels these institutions are a global world order that the MAGA movement has to kind of tame and reduce. And of course, more critically, large corporations, especially big tech and U.S. firms, feel the ILO conventions to be too onerous, or in Trump's word, too socialist. You must remember that the ILO is the last bastion that talks about the social wage, about health and safety in the workplace, about minimum wages, about, especially now in the last few weeks, they have ratified a treaty on gig workers. Now, gig workers are all those hundreds and thousands of workers that work below the minimum wage for the large U.S. big tech corporations, and they have been exploited. And if the U.S. were to sign on the ILO and this treaty, it would bind the big tech corporations to these minimum wage standards, and these big tech are a major contributor to the Trump campaign. So they're all interconnected.
Now, that then begs the question, Ashraf, what sort of criteria or perhaps yardstick would the U.S. use, if any, to determine whether a country's labor practices warrant any trade penalties? Because we certainly could not make sense of the trade wars a little bit earlier, how the Trump administration arrived at various figures. I hope this is not one of the same.
Yes, yes. You must remember those 60 countries are across the global south. And technically, one can argue that in China, India, large parts of Africa, in the Amazon, where there's mining, there is forced labor. There's a lot of prison labor, but a lot of it is very difficult to verify because these are zones that are in forests or mining zones. And, you know, to get national labor organizations to verify the nature of the labor, it's a very complex exercise, and it's subject to interpretation. And I think they're using the opaque nature of this. But it is a trade tactic, because What it can do is saying, look, China, if you are manufacturing Apple iPhones using, let's say, 20% of the labor force comes from your prisons, they can say that's forced labor, and they can use that in then strong arming China on some concessions in the kind of rare earth space. So it is quite strategic. It is very mischievous, of course, because every other country can use the same, subject to interpretation.
Let's talk about the so-called moral authority. Does Washington have a moral authority when it simply just judges other countries' labor practices? Again, very rich coming from the US, considering its track record and history over decades.
Definitely, definitely. You must remember, labor has always been politicized from the time of Workers' Day that was declared in 1889. The socialist world mobilized around workers to build the communist states of the last century. Of course, the U.S. at the time also used Labor Day and labor rights to mobilize a sufficiently good quality labor force to enable capitalism to grow. So there was symbiosis in the days after World War II, in the post kind of Roosevelt era, where labor was a key pillar of all the U.S. administrations. They realized that you needed a strong middle class and working class to make capitalism work. Because although capitalism is exploitative, it does need a healthy and skilled working force to make it work. So there was that understanding up until the last 10 years with the deregulation and attack on labor all round. So they are at a tipping point, because if they do not invest in their workers, what's going to happen is they're going to become uncompetitive. Whereas China and other rivals are beginning to invest much more in skills development, technical, health and safety. I think these are the issues that when countries underinvest, then you cannot be competitive. So they are in a difficult situation. We are seeing, even now with the Middle East wars, the capitulation of the Trump administration to China, the quagmire in the Middle East, these desperate measures of trade and tariffs. These are all symptoms of a declining empire, you know, just as the German empire kind of also collapsed, just as the Russian empire collapsed in the late 80s. It was on a number of key factors. And I think we're now facing that moment in the next decade where the U.S. is also facing this moment of decline, but it's going to be a very slow decline, and they will still remain a superpower, but in a multipolar world. And that means they have to contend with multipolarity. They have to begin to realize that the United Nations is still the very best we have, despite all its shortcomings. It has the standards, it has the agreements on all the major polycrises of the world, be it climate change, be it labor, be it industrialization, be it gender, be it finance for development. These issues are fundamental for all nations, including the U.S. And so they have to find a way to make these international agreements work, and they need to learn to play in a fair game. I think that is the best that they can follow now.
What do you think, Ashraf, with a minute, and then we have to wrap? It was argued last year that in the midst of the trade tariff war, South Africa was very timid, even in respect of the propaganda and lies around a white Afrikaner genocide continuing still to be perpetuated by the Trump administration, that we were rather timid then. What should our response be like now?
Well, South Africa can be more robust. I think working within the BRICS framework, BRICS nations unfortunately, each one is cutting different deals with the Trump administration and the EU. There's no BRICS inter-trade treaty as yet. The second element is, sadly, there's been a lot of divisions across the African continent. There's been regional hegemons, South Africa versus Kenya versus Egypt versus Rwanda. And the US and EU are exploiting this. And as we've seen with the Kenya summit with France, etc. So back to basics, back to Africa Union, back to a common African free trade agreement with common positions and common standards so that the US does not use free trade agreements per country and exploit as they're doing in Zambia and Kenya, as an example.
Ashraf Patel, geopolitical analyst, as always, thanks so much for your time on PM Drive.
Shukran. Wa alaikum salam.